Computer, initialize holosuite.
Good evening and welcome to the Fire Caves, a Star Trek Deep Space Nine podcast. This will be our actual first episode in which we do our deep dive on, of course, the pilot for Star Trek Deep Space Nine. Now, joined with me today is my co-host David. David, say hi.
Hi.
And since this is David's first run through with Deep Space Nine, we will be talking a lot about his first impressions and main takeaways of the episode, whereas I, a person who's watched this show many, many, many times, will still try to relay my own first impressions, but also nitpick to death the show that I love so much. In addition to that, we'll also be getting into some historical context for this show, and how I feel, we feel, everybody feels, the history of the 90s really did lay some of the framework for what we saw throughout this show's run. So up to that point, we're just going to give a brief synopsis of the episode and then roll on from there. So, this is the pilot.
The Emissary.
The Emissary, correct. Great name, a word I did not know until watching this episode. So we meet our protagonist, Benjamin Sisko, in conflict in this one. In fact, David, this was something that you were telling me you had you just watched kind of the other side of with Star Trek The Next Generation. So you want to start there?
Sure, yes. So the episode opens with the season 3 finale and then the season 4 premiere of The Next Generation, the episodes The Best of Both Worlds, where in particular Jean-Luc Picard, the captain of the Enterprise, is temporarily made into a member of the Borg Hive, I believe that's what they're called, and because of the knowledge they gleaned from his mind, he's able to lead them toward Earth, and there's a big battle where Sisko is one of the a commander on a ship that is part of that battle, and they are easily defeated. Yes, they're easily defeated, and in that battle, Sisko's wife dies, and that is we keep coming back to here for the rest of the episode. It becomes very important for this episode.
And so we meet, of course, like you said, we meet Sisko then on the Saratoga. We then see him arriving at Deep Space Nine, where he's coming into this very, kind of rustic, rundown, beaten up, old Cardassian, now under the Bajoran control, but going to be administrated by the Federation. And Sisko's going to be heading that up. We meet several new faces, new crew members, new just people that are going to be a part of the society that they're forming there. And of course, we eventually discover the wormhole, the prophets, the aliens, the wormhole aliens that live there, and we start to begin to understand the significance of all this to both the space station and the planet it now orbits, Bajor. So, of course, that is a very, very succinct summation of the episode, but we'll get into finer points as we continue our talk. Before that, though, I do want to talk about, again, historical framework. So this show came out in the early 90s. I believe it was 1994 when we watched the first episode, January 25th, 1994, if I'm not mistaken. And there were a lot of things that were going on in society, in American society in particular, that really kind of lend themselves to Star Trek Deep Space Nine. One of the biggest is most likely going to be the idea of multiculturalism. It was just starting to have some serious connotations in society and the way that we do things. And this is basically just saying it was a time we're seeing in which various ethnic groups were beginning to collaborate and enter into dialogue with one another without there being a feeling that you have to sacrifice your ethnic identity with the collective group. Okay, so we're seeing, basically it was the scene that there were a lot of factions that were starting to come together, but still being able to, you know, stay true to themselves. We also were seeing the end of the Cold War was happening around the same time. And with that, you know, you have a lot of people who were used to a very, you know, I guess, tense, heightened militaristic stance, and are now focused more on having to be focused more on living in a post-war society, coming down from that kind of mentality, and looking more into rehabilitation. And I think that the first episode of Deep Space Nine does a great job of kind of highlighting that, in the sense that we arrive at this, again, broken down space station that was used to be home to the Cardassian oppressors and is now being occupied by those they used to oppress. And it's dirty, it's dingy, it's dark, it's smoky, all these things. And here we are from our fresh, clean, pristine Starship Enterprise to this very dark, dirty area. So, and with all the other cultures scattered around, it was nice to see that they were trying to highlight that, and that there's this central focus of bringing everyone together. So, David.
Yeah.
What were your first impressions of this episode?
Well, before I say anything, I have to make a slight correction to you, Perry. It's 1993, not 1994.
Oh, wow.
You had the date right, except for the year.
Okay.
I'm going to go ahead and say this now for everyone. Perry's mind is like a steel trap. He remembers things very well. I will have to refer to notes in my memory while constantly referring to Perry, but this is the one time that that steel mind of a brain has failed you, Perry. You got the date off by a year.
1 year off. Fine.
Well, I found this episode to be very interesting, you know, having just watched The Next Generation. You know, the opening episode of The Next Generation lays out what the show is supposed to be. The Enterprise crew, and particularly Picard, are challenged by the enigmatic pain in the butt Q to defend humanity in particular. Why should humanity exist if we've been a bunch of people who just argue and fight and war with each other? Why should higher beings ever care to let them even so much as live, is kind of Q's argument, if I could summarize it in that episode. But what that means is that Picard isn't himself really the interest of the episode, in the sense of it's not a personal journey that he goes on in that first episode, not like Sisko does in this one. Sisko has a very similar overall experience. He is challenged by some beings that we don't really know a lot about at this time to explain himself. Not, you know, all of humanity necessarily, even though Sisko has to do that. His purpose in the episode, as the first episode, is to explain kind of what this show is about. And so we have Deep Space Nine having to deal with, you know, all these cultures coming together, as you just described. But for Sisko in particular, this is a personal story, more so than, for example, Picard ever had there on The Next Generation, which, you know, I find really interesting. And, you know, one thing you've told me about the reason you enjoy this show, if I can bring this up, is for you, part of the reason you enjoy this show is because you kind of think of Sisko as like a Batman type character to Picard's Superman. And in this episode, you really get that when the two of them interact. You know, Picard is the, you know, the hero of The Next Generation. And again, I haven't finished all the entire run of The Next Generation show, so there, I know there's some things that I had not yet caught up on. But in general, you know, here's Picard. He's this upstanding captain of a ship that is very fun. You know, like the opening sequence, the credits, you know, The Next Generation show has a fanfare with, you know, da 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 da, you know, very, very fun, and let's go get them, and we have an objective, and this is, oh, just great and glorious fun. And then here comes Deep Space Nine with a very, you know, subdued, very,
yes, the singular trombone.
Yeah, it's very subdued. It's slow pannings around this space station. It's almost a bit melancholy in some ways. It's telling a story that's more subtle. At least the music is telling us it is. So yeah, I found the characters particularly. Give me a moment here while I refer to her. Kira, Major Kira. Mm-hmm. I found her immediately compelling. Unfortunately, I think she was more compelling as a female warrior type than what's the name of the character from The Next Generation from season one? Perry, remind me.
I need more of a description of the season one character. Tasha Yar?
That's it. I felt like Kira, or at least the actress who plays Kira, I was sold on her character being, you know, she's put
antagonistic.
Down. Well, not to say antagonistic, but, you know, she really has to step up in this episode because she has to defend the space station, Deep Space Nine. Yeah. So, yeah, it's a very compelling episode. These are people who are... The underdog is always the one you automatically kind of root for. So you're, right. You are invested in some of these characters a little bit more than I would say you are initially with the Next Generation cast.
Yeah.
And yeah.
So, and so in coming from, you know, Next Generation, where, you know, again, everybody is very well put together and their issues are often external versus internal. You know, you come into Deep Space Nine and it's, we see that it's going to be different almost right away. Right. And so, you know, you were talking about Major Kira. And so we get a brief history here of what's been going on her home planet, Bajor, right? Mm-hmm. So we know that there has been this occupying alien force, the Cardassians, have been basically ransacking, ravaging, screwing over this planet for the past 50 years.
Right.
So we know that these people have been thoroughly brutalized by them, and they've just now thrown off the yoke of the oppressor, right? And they're establishing themselves once again. And you hear Kira in her opening moment. She's telling the other Bajorans, I'm assuming he was planet side, you mm-hmm. know, she's telling him how you're throwing it all away. She's saying it. That's her line. You know, you're throwing it all away. And she's talking about that independence, that hard-fought independence that they just secured, and now here they are inviting in the Federation. And, you know, to her, she's a Bajoran national. She fought in the trenches. She was part of that insurrection that threw off the Cardassians. To see another unknown alien entity roll in, I'm sure that it was not just something that angered her, it probably terrified her. You know, you just gotten rid of somebody that's brutalized your entire planet for a couple of generations now,
right?
And you've just gotten rid of them, and here comes another one, and they're, you know, as far as you're concerned, they could be the exact same. And, you know, and of course we have Sisko, who, you know, his job, as spelled out to him in that infamous meeting between him and Picard, mm-hmm. his job is to do everything barring breaking the Prime Directive to bring Bajor into the Federation fold,
right?
You know, so yeah, the whole setup of it was one that I think from the beginning was going to be a very emotional play for everybody involved.
Right.
And I love the fact that they highlight all that, like, from the beginning. Like, I think the whole opening, probably 25 minutes of the show, is nothing but these very tense, emotional moments between people. We have Sisko and Picard meeting, and that explosive scene, which, I mean, I still love everything about it. I love watching it. Like, it's one of few pilots that I will go back and watch just for that scene.
Yeah,
in most
great.
Cases, yeah, you know, in most cases you're trying to get away from the pilots, like get into the shows because the pilots are always so terrible. But that scene, it was like, I don't know, it was amazing to me, and
yeah.
I think a lot of people will say the same.
Yeah, I Patrick Stewart is. You know, Sir Patrick Stewart, he's known for his dramatic action, you know, or, you know, Shakespearean acting career. But yeah, Avery Brooks as Benjamin Sisko immediately steps up and says, I don't like you.
Yeah. Not quite so nice, but
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And the two of them together, I mean, I was thinking as the episode ends and they've come to a amicable parting, I was like, man, I know that, you know, the character of Picard is not on this show. You know, I'd be very, very happy to see more of these two characters have to interact.
You know, and I think that has been something that's been echoed throughout for a lot of different Trek fans, is to see those two have to go at it a little bit more to work on smoothing that over. Because, you know, I remember watching this a long time ago for the first time. And having watched Next Generation, you know, Picard was a favorite, you know.
Right.
And so to see this new guy step in and then not only, like, get in Picard's face, but to kind of make Picard, like, shrink away a little bit at first.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Picard comes into the meeting and he's very positive. He's very welcoming.
Yeah.
Right. And Sisko is just cold the whole time.
Right.
And then it's like the closer Picard gets to him, the angrier he gets.
Yeah.
Until finally there's like this clash of recognition and Picard's like, oh, crap.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's something that he's struggled with dealing with, that whole being assimilated thing.
Oh, yeah.
And to have somebody who is on the direct other side of that, who has basically focused all of his pain, all of his anger, all of it is aimed squarely at Jean-Luc Picard.
Yeah, that face
he's
got
to deal with.
Yeah. For years, yeah.
Right. And he does. If you watch the scene, like, Picard shrinks away. It's the first time you ever really see Picard distance himself from a situation, you know, and it takes him a second to kind of, you know, regain his footing and come back.
Yeah.
And it was very telling about how damaging that Borg assimilation was to him, that he did this.
Oh yeah.
And again, I remember watching it and being like, how dare Sisko talk to our dear beloved captain this way, you know? And it took a long time for me to get to a point where I could actually understand where Sisko was coming from, you know, like,
sure. Yeah.
I mean, the amount of suffering that he went through and the struggles he was going through, just trying to maintain, and then confronted with the face of the man who killed his wife.
Oh, yeah.
You know, however, you know, you want to say, yeah, he was controlled by the Borg, whatever. Still, he's the one.
He was in the Borg specifically chose Picard to be there. Emissary for their you know, conquering of Earth. So yeah, but I love that that scene, because, you know, yeah, Picard starts off as, hey, friendly, hey, you're here, this is good, this is great, you know, do what they can to bring the people into the Federation, and then Sisko just is doing everything but sneering in his face.
Yeah.
And then Picard has that moment, you know, as soon as Sisko, you know, says his piece, you know, and Picard immediately turns around and is, you know, he's got that kind of guilt and shame. Like, you know, one of the best episodes I've seen so far from Next Generation was the episode right after The Best of Both Worlds, where Picard has to kind of, in that episode, confront his brother, who's hostile to him,
yes.
But they work, you know, his brother helps him work out that grief in that one episode of what happened. And again, I haven't seen much beyond that at this point, but I imagine that if it ever is brought up again, you know, Picard will always express grief and sadness for what happened. He knows that he's not directly responsible, but that episode really, you know, Picard says, I could have tried harder, I could have stopped it, I could have done something, and his brother's like, nope, you couldn't, and you have to accept that. And so this episode is the other side of that. Okay, so Picard, he's kind of gotten over it, and then he's suddenly reminded by someone who's been traumatized by that event. And, yeah, it was so great. But then it was also great because at the end of that scene, Picard, you know, says, hey, do you want to be here? And he's like, no, I don't want to be here. Sisko's like, I don't want to be here. I'm thinking about going and being a civilian back on Earth. And Picard gets just as cold. He turns to him and says, look, if you're not ready to do this job, then we need to find someone else.
Yeah.
So he says, you know what, screw that anger you have at me in this moment. We got stuff to do, and you need to be there on board, or we got to figure out what else we're going to do. I can't let your anger at me turn us both from our mission.
Exactly.
And great scene.
And I think that's always been Picard's saving grace, and that's when you really notice that he kind of, I guess, takes his power back, if you want to use any kind of colloquial term for it.
Right.
It's when he's able to rely on Starfleet and your duty, that's when he comes through strongest. Because he does, like I said, he shrinks away from Sisko a little bit, but when they get to that point where he's like, yeah, it seems like you don't want to be here, and Sisko's like, yeah, I'm raising a child alone in this, you know, frontier of space. It's not an ideal environment.
I've already seen the consequences of that.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. He's in a roundabout way, he's saying, you've already taken my wife from me. I'm not going to let you take my kid.
Right.
And Picard is right there to be like, well, look, you're a Starfleet officer. So as long as you're in that uniform, you are expected to perform your duty.
Right.
And that has always been Picard's, his line. He says he gets to that a lot. Duty, doing your job, being dedicated, that is his thing. And so, where he recovers. And Sisko, but even then, Sisko doesn't let it faze him, doesn't let it beat him. He's just like, yeah, I know that. And I'm going to do the job to the best of my ability. But in the meantime, you should be looking for my replacement because he did not cower. And I respected both in that situation.
Yeah, it was a fantastic scene.
Yeah, and I think that if you watch it, a few times, especially coming from kind of the idol worship that we have with Picard for a long time to this and seeing that, it takes you a bit before you can actually appreciate what you are watching between those two characters. Right. And I think that if we had seen maybe like a couple of episodes where before they finally got to any kind of amicable understanding of each other, where they had a few more tense scenes like that and having to really kind of work it out.
Right.
That would have been great. But I think that's just also a sign of the times.
Mm-hmm.
Back then it was more about, we don't want to tarnish our hero too much. And Picard was definitely our hero.
Right.
So he got knocked a little bit, but we had to see that, happy conclusion by the end of the episode. We get that. And, that was very important. That was the passing of the torch. Right. So now we can totally distinguish these shows.
Yeah.
And that was that.
Yeah. On a similar point, this episode, the Deep Space Nine crew is like waiting for the Enterprise to come back and kind of save them. So it was also interesting this episode to see the other side of that. The Enterprise always comes to save the day, but in The Next Generation, it's always like, oh, how much further till we get to what, what's in what? Or we have to be somewhere because something's happening. This time, there's a time ticking. If they don't come, if the Enterprise doesn't come back, that's a problem. So it was again very. It was great to see these characters have to step up again, like Kira, and she did a good job.
Kira is also one of those characters that, knowing that she stand out to me, but she maintained she was a personal favorite for a long time. Still is. It's not like I'm saying like there was a long time and then she was replaced by someone else. I've always loved the dynamic of Kira. I like that she, she's very hands-on in everything that she was doing. And I think that was kind of the finer point they were trying to put on why she couldn't necessarily lead the space station at that time. And like, we see her later on in the episode, she's down on the promenade, and she's clearing up some debris and things like that. And,
right.
And she's just, so it's like she's flitting from one thing to the next. Even when we first see her meeting with Sisko, she's talking to some guy, arguing, with him before she finally turns and addresses Sisko. And then even in the middle of addressing Sisko, there's another alert that happens and she's on it. She barely allows for there to be any kind of drop in the conversation or whatever. And she's right there and she's already contacting the security chief and they're already running down to handle this thing. She's all over the place trying to hold everything together. And it was clear that like, while yes, she could do it, she'd probably face burnout like so quick. And they needed somebody who did have a better understanding, I guess, of the administrative aspect of things. And of course, here's Sisko, trained to lead, trained to do exactly that.
Right.
And she just wasn't giving him any ground at first. And he came off as quirky in those first moments. I really didn't know if I was going to like him. Because she's like so serious. And he's just like, following her around and stuff. And it's like, okay.
All smiles.
Really
making a point to kind of get under her skin a little bit. Right. I'm here and you got to deal with it.
Right. I'm not going anywhere. That was his whole kind of attitude.
Yeah.
So beyond Kira, any other first impressions of crew members or just people that you saw in this episode?
Yeah, so Quark, the Ferengi.
Ferengi bartender.
Yeah, we'll see more of him, I know. As I said in our episode zero, I was going to be wondering how they join the Federation, and this episode answers that. They haven't, well, I mean, again, unless more happens on the Next Generation, which I haven't seen yet, it's not that the Ferengi joined the Federation in this episode, it's that they were already on this Deep Space Nine space station, and here the Federation has come to help administer that space station, and so, hey, Ferengi, Mr. Quark, we need some help keeping people here and keeping culture here, and, you know, it's not just an abandoned spaceship out in the middle of nowhere, or space station, abandoned. I do think that Benjamin Sisko's ploy of threatening to hold and prosecute the nephew of Quark, which part of me thinks he's not actually a nephew, but actually the son of Quark, but I'll figure out if that's true or not later. The idea that Sisko was willing to... the bribe's not the right word. What's the word I'm looking for? Strong arm. Yeah, the Ferengi in order to staying on. And I guess they helped Odo, you know, get on the Cardassian ship because they used him as a bag. I don't know if that was something Quark was intentionally doing or not. But yeah, like I said, I was curious to see how the Ferengi ended up as a part of this group. But yeah. So is it what Lieutenant Dax, the space or the science officer?
Mm-hmm.
The idea that she would go through some sort of procedure where she has some alien creature inserted into her belly.
So this is actually the second time that we meet the species, her species. They're called Trill. It's the second time that we see them in Star Trek history. We saw them in an early episode on The Next Generation, but they looked radically different. So you'd be completely forgiven for not remembering that they are actually the same species. So on Next Generation, I believe when they first showed the Trill, they had like a set of like, I guess they had a weird like elongated ridge line in their foreheads, like a series of little bumps or whatever, and then they completely went away with that, and they did the dots, kind of like a series of birthmarks, basically down the sides of Judzi's face.
Right.
And the story goes that they had done the original makeup on the actress playing Judzi Dax. That's Terry Farrow, and they didn't like it. Like, Terry is a very beautiful woman, and they were just like, we're not going to cover that up and make her ugly with these bumps all along her face.
Right.
So they had to figure out another way to distinguish that she was an alien, and that was the design they went with, and I don't think there's a single person who's ever been like, that was a bad move. Like, everybody's appreciated it. You can find pictures online of them doing the test with the original makeup on her, and I've seen it, and I would tell you, they'd made a great choice to go the other way. The dots, the spots, however you want to think of them, are much better. Now,
I'm sure, yeah.
Yeah. So the Trill are what's called a joined species. That means that they exist in two parts. You have the actual physical body, obviously, but then the procedure that you're talking about is where they're joined with what's called a symbiont. And the symbiont is this seemingly immortal creature that they pass from person to person or host to host, as you'll hear it referred to many times in the show. And this allows each host to experience all the memories, all of the sensations, everything else of those previous lives. And this thing acts as kind of like a glorified black box, basically. Like, it doesn't have any, like, as far as we're told anyway, it doesn't have any individual personality or distinction of its own.
Oh.
It just kind of records these things of all the people that it's been joined with. So, like, when they eventually, either they grow old and die, or something happens to them and they die, or whatever it is, the symbiont is taken out and put in another person.
Gotcha.
So, Dax is the name of the symbiont. Her name then becomes Jadzia Dax. So every person that's joined to the Dax symbiont loses their last name and becomes whatever Dax. So her previous host was Curzon Dax. she is now the seventh iteration of the Dax host as Jadzia. Right. And we will learn more about the various hosts that she's had. And that's why Sisko makes the joke about the fact that she's over 300 years old. It's like, yeah. Technically, no, she's not. She's really like 28, I think. But
yeah, that's what she says, yeah.
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 But yeah, the other lives joined together, yeah. 328.
Well, I'm glad you described it as like a black box. You know, it doesn't have a personality, because there was definitely a part of me that's like, I don't think I would be okay with that.
Yeah, no, yeah.
Memories are not.
Yeah, right. I don't want this thing in me that can control me. No.
Yeah.
But basically, it's a way for them to, again, they share the memories, the experiences. A lot of times, like, we'll see that brought about certain personality changes because they were remembering things from lives from several iterations ago, you know. Right. And that's something that they do touch on a couple of times in this show. So you'll get to see more of that, mm-hmm. as we go through it. We'll spoilers there. But, yeah, but Dax definitely comes off as, different. To say the least.
Right.
Everybody else. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I found it a little weird. Sisko sees her and says, it's good to see you, old man, or something to that effect. And I'm like, mm-hmm. he just kind of knows who she is already. Like, he knew the other version of her or him.
Right.
It was one of those
That's
moments.
The story.
Yeah. It was just, I was like, Sisko's just like, he knows who this is and is already making jokes. So I imagine there's more there, but I'm also surprised by how quickly he recognized, you know, Jadzia as Dax.
Well, the spots are a dead giveaway. I mean...
Oh, is that it? Okay.
Yeah,
all
Trill have them. And then I'm sure that, I mean, like, it's made kind of clear that he knew at least of her in the academy and whatnot. Like, almost like he had been keeping tabs on her a little bit.
Right.
You know, and I'm sure that, again... So the story with them is he was best friends with her previous host, Curzon. And so I'm sure that, you know, when she was joined and became Jadzia Dax, I'm sure she reached out to him at some point to let him know that, you know, she was no longer Curzon, that Curzon had, you know, died and now she was Jadzia.
Right.
You know, so, yeah, because there's nothing wrong with them maintaining their friendship. So,
That makes sense.
It's kind of left for us to assume that that's, somewhere along the way, that's what happened. That, like, gotcha. You know, he became aware that she was now Jadzia and that, you know, he'd just been waiting for her to get through with some things to request her to join him on his next assignment. So, it's immediately supposed to be that these two are definitely old friends and have a very strong established relationship.
Right. Yeah, they got to working together this episode. Lickety split. Want to go jump into a wormhole together? Let's do it.
Sure, yeah. And, you know, much to the doctor's dismay, you know, he's coming off that transporter with her.
Yeah.
And he was, screw getting to work. He was like, nah, let's, you want to go get a drink?
You know?
And you're just like, no, man. Go do your job. Like, Jesus.
Yeah. Yeah, it was interesting. You know, his character was perfectly cast as a kind of, as a good foil to Sisko as, oh, I love being out here. I'm on the frontier of medicine here and taking adventures. You know, Sisko's like, I'll do it if I have to. And then here comes Mr. Bashir. And he's like, yeah, this is great. And then as soon as, you know, things get a little tough, you can tell he has a moment of like, what did I get myself into? But, you know, he jumps out there and takes care of some injured people on the station. So that was... I imagine if they play that up on the show that, you know, Bashir, well, I guess now Sisko's there and he wants to be there and he's kind of moved on. So that conflict of the two of them that could have been there is probably gone now. But, yeah.
Well, yeah. And, you know, the doctor really does put his foot into it, you know, steps his foot into it when he is talking about how he's so excited to be out here in the wilderness and, you know, this is frontier medicine. And Kira is like, this is my home. Like,
yeah.
You're talking about you chose to be here. Like, we're some kind of backwood whatever.
Right.
I live here. Everybody that I know and love is here. This is not, you know, a game.
Yeah.
You know, and he does play that kind of nervous, neurotic, stumbling bit. very well at first. And then, yes, of course, we do see him come into his own a little bit when he shows his medical competency. So, yeah, I mean, I think that was their kind of their goal was to show him as being, you know, very youthful, very naive. He's, I think, to me, he represents more of that very idealistic aspect of Starfleet, right? And he's a freshly minted Starfleet officer straight from medical school, and he's out here to do big things and to you know, make his mark and not taking into consideration that he's in this area where, you know, it's ravaged, it's war-torn. These people are suffering from varying degrees of PTSD, to say the least, of their other worries and stuff. And that kind of blind optimism charging into a scenario is wildly inappropriate. And Kira is right there in his face to remind him of that, you know, right. And kind of bring him back down to reality.
Yeah, I was definitely waiting for the camera to pan over her to her while he was, this is great, I'm on the frontier of medicine, this is just gonna be one big grand adventure, and waiting for the camera to pan over to her and him just, or her just say something to what she did. Yeah, like, I, this is my home.
Yeah,
how dare you.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So then, of course, we move into our, you know, our big mystery, right? Our mystery is Sisko's been trying to arrange a meeting with the spiritual leader of Bajor, but this person has been in seclusion and isolation. No one knows where this individual is, and of course we're talking about the Kai, which is basically like the Pope or the Prime Minister, if you wanted to combine those two, the Pope and Prime Minister together. You know, the Kai is the spiritual focal point of the Bajoran people, and they are a deeply religious people, and they believe very much that their faith, the belief in the prophets, the name of their god beings, the prophets,
right,
is what brought them through the occupation. And so Sisko feels he needs to meet with the Kai, he needs to establish his presence and get basically their blessing to continue his job. And as he's trying to find this person, of course, he does have his meeting with the Kai, but she's just like, I can only help you if you do these things. I need you to warn the prophets. And he's, you know, he's very resistant at first, but she's just like, I can't do anything until you do it. So Blackmail kind of becomes like a theme in this show, you know, because she's just like, yeah, I mean, I understand what you want, but what I want is, you know, you need to do this thing.
Well, she does say, if I remember correctly, she says, I can't give to you what you deny yourself, I think is what she says.
Oh, she does say that, but she says it later.
Okay.
When we're talking about the initial meeting when she meets with him and she gives first orb.
Right. I can't unify all the people until certain things happen, and you have to do those for me. That's what she says. That's right.
Yes. Until the prophets are warned, I cannot help you.
Right.
And so she gives him the orb to help him out. And this is the first time we see the orb artifact in the box, you know. And
what was
Sisko
its name? She calls it like the tear or something.
They call it the tear of the prophets.
Tear of the prophets. And, as in like tear crying tear? Or
yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. All right.
Because the myth is that these orbs, as they've appeared, the tears of the prophets, there are several of them, have appeared at various times to the Bajoran people, each one serving a different function, a different purpose. Mm-hmm. And the one that Sisko is exposed to is the Orb of Time, if I remember correctly.
Oh.
And he...
Spoiler alert.
Yeah. Well... I believe it's called the Orb of Time. And what you saw, when she opens it up and exposes it to him, he's transported back in time to a moment in his own history.
True.
And he meets his wife for the first time.
Right.
On the beach.
Right.
And
gets to relive that experience.
Yes. And he comes up with quite possibly the smoothest line I have ever heard, and I've loved it. And I watched again a scene that I watch over and over again just for that moment. It's where they're walking on the beach, and once he's realized where he is and what's happened, he's talking to Jennifer, and he introduces himself. He's Benjamin Sisko. They met at George's party. All these things are coming up. And he tells her that he just got out of the academy. He's a junior officer. And she says, my mother told me to watch out for junior officers. And he's like, your mother's going to
love
your
me.
Mother's going to love me.
Yeah.
And she's like, I bet you say that to all. No, what does she say? Like,
she says, I bet you've said that to all kinds of women, or says something to that effect. And he says,
never. He says, never before and never again.
Yeah, great
and
line.
She was like, yeah. And, but well, the best part is the next part, because I mean, I thought that was great, but then he lays it like he nails the rest of it, because she's like, uh huh. And he's like, well, it's not every day you meet the woman you're going to marry.
Yeah.
And he just, I mean, I was just like, man,
yeah,
that guy, like, that's how he got her, like, right there. That was it.
Right. Yeah.
That exchange was done.
Yeah.
And you could even see the look on her face, like, she was impressed.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know what? Whoever wrote this, they, like, nailed it with those two. Because
yeah.
I thought that was fantastic.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, in that moment, the Jennifer, her character, is having to give him a lot of, you know, rope to work with as he starts to follow her around on the beach. But yeah, as soon as she lets him have his moment to really connect with her, yeah, it was a fun scene. And it was the whole episode did a great job of showing little glimpses of who they were as a couple.
Yeah.
And you're like, damn, I can see why he misses her quite a bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think they do a great job of selling the fact that he was very much in love with his wife,
right,
and that her loss was very devastating to him.
Right.
And, of course, this again, that leads us into them discovering the wormhole, him and Jadzia going to the wormhole, and him meeting the wormhole aliens, which we later find out they are the prophets. They're the ones the orbs came from. They're tears. These are them.
Yeah.
And these are them. These are they, you know. And he is having to explain corporeal existence to them.
Yeah.
And they're using these kind of snapshots from his life to understand what he's talking about.
Right.
And, yeah, we have to see again and again that heartbreaking scene of Jennifer's death.
Yeah.
And seeing her importance to him, they're on a picnic in a park, and that's where he proposed, and all, like, all these things. And we have his son; he's playing baseball with his son, and you know, so we see that family is very important to Sisko.
Yeah,
and we learn a lot about Sisko through these moments, and we keep hearing that line repeated over and over again: "You exist here. You exist here.
Right.
You keep coming back here."
Right,
and
right.
Yeah, so like. He's teaching them, but they're also teaching him and showing him how to get over it, you know, how to get past things.
Yeah, that whole scene was very interesting. Again, as I was saying earlier, you know, Picard in episode one of The Next Generation and the other characters, but particularly him, they have to make the case for why humanity. But this episode has to make, you know, Sisko has to make the case for what and know how and why, but on a more fundamental level. And he says, when he's describing baseball, that we are defined by what we don't know. As humans, we are interested in not only answering our questions, but finding new questions to ask. And that's a great philosophy for this show, and particularly Star Trek, and it definitely seems to fit in with it. And I think for that reason, I mean, the first time I watched Q, I mean, I'm sure everyone has this experience, like, who is this petty being who has nothing better to do but just annoy apparently everyone, including the other Qs?
Yeah. Yeah. Apparently he annoys everybody. That's his thing.
But, you know, because these beings, these prophets, as you've said, are having to ask more fundamental questions, they're not there to play games. They're there to ask serious questions of Sisko in these scenes. You really get some interesting answers from Sisko. But I have to say, above everything else that I've said that was great about this episode, the one thing I love the most, and we've had several moments of these, like we just said, is when Sisko, being confronted by these memories of his dead wife, he cries. As a English major in college, I love reading about, you know, the art of storytelling. And I've always thought, you know, if I were to write a story, like really commit to writing a story, which I've never done before, I would want a scene where my main character cries over some sort of regret. There's just something, there's some emotional catharsis that needs to happen, which expresses itself in weeping, in crying of some kind. And yeah, that moment where he, I mean, why are you here? Why do we come here? Why is this the thing we keep coming back to? And Sisko has to think about it and just realize, yeah, I've never really been able to give this moment up. And he cries over it. He has an emotional catharsis in this episode. And it's great. It's fantastic.
He said his line, I believe he says, I've never figured out how to live without her.
Right.
And they say, so you choose to exist here.
Right.
And they're saying it's not linear, and he's completely lost in the moment.
Right.
It was, yeah, beautiful scene. Oh, very heartbreaking scene.
Yeah, fantastic. I mean, if nothing else in this scene, in this show, in this first episode had been something to enjoy, that alone would have been something that I would have been moved by. Because again, catharsis, that's what storytelling is supposed to be, catharsis. We go on a journey with characters and experience that with them. And it's a bold move to make a main character, the leader of the show, cry on the first episode. I mean, I know Picard has, you know, again as a comparison, has like shed tears, like when he was, you know, as a Borg, he shed a tear, very you know, dignified. He's still in there somewhere, and there have been moments where he's been passionate, but. Let me put it this way: the scene where he and his brother on Earth in the vineyard. There we go. There it is. In the vineyard, and they start fighting, which turns into kind of basically play fighting in the mud, and then you know Picard cries. He kind of gets over that moment a little more quickly than Sisko does. Sisko has to really sit there for a minute and. Ah, man, that's the stuff, man. That's where it's at. So,
absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. And this also brings us to what we have been saying earlier, that ending where when Sisko and Picard meet up again, and we can see that Sisko has, it's not necessarily that he's gotten to a point where he can forgive Picard, but he's definitely gotten to a point where he can now cope. And he can exist, and he can begin to move forward.
Right.
And he's ready to at least start embracing his duty again. And
right.
Doing his job with a newfound, you know, with that
purpose. Right,
newfound excitement. Right.
Yeah.
And purpose to doing it. So, I mean, just there's a lot in this episode. It's kind of like, you know, just a great ride. Definitely one you... I just don't feel like you really expect, because again, coming from Next Generation into this, and this is the pilot, and you're getting this emotional roller coaster with our commander. We have these weird aliens that, I mean, they just don't give us a whole lot right away to work with. We've got the Cardassians are floating around here somewhere just being angry aggressors, and you're just like, kind of want them to go away. You know, like all of these things that are popping up, and it's just like, by the end of the episode, you just feel like it was a lot. So, when you were done at the end of the episode, what was your first initial thoughts when it was over?
I think like I said, with Sisko having that emotional moment was the moment I think was the best moment in the entire episode. I mean, I don't know if there's anything I could really say. It ended. I was ready for the next one. You know, I've been watching at least two episodes a night for the last couple of weeks in order to prepare for us getting here. Ready for the next one. I guess my biggest question at the moment is the space station, Deep Space Nine, always going to take trips out into space and out of orbit pretty regularly? Because it's just a spaceship. Oh,
so,
no comment. He doesn't say anything.
I'm gonna go ahead and say no. That was a one-time only scenario.
Ah, okay, all right.
Yeah, that was very important. That once it was established that was a wormhole, they wanted to stake their claim to it before the Cardassians could come back in, use that as a ploy to, you know, reoccupy Bajor. So yes, they Starfleeted their way. into a maneuver to move that whole giant space station closer to stake their claim to it and make themselves a dominant power. But no, that is the only time that the space station ever moves.
Really?
So yeah, that was it.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah, no, Mr. O'Brien was very important. Influential. I thought that wasn't quite the right word, but important, influential in that scene, getting it all to work. Again, on The Next Generation, he's just been our reliable transporter room 3 guy.
Yeah.
So I'm curious to see. I mean, again, I know there's probably more to his character as I finish The Next Generation, but so far, he's kind of flat. No. So I hope we'll see more of it. More of him, yeah.
I'm just gonna go ahead and tell you that's it. That's all you really see of him on Next Gen.
Yeah.
I mean, he has a few minor moments where he's a little actiony, I guess, right, is the best way to think of it. But other than that, no, he is Transporter Chief,
right?
Miles O'Brien, and right. Deep Space Nine was an attempt to let him kind of spread his wings, grow, and develop the character a bit, which you know, I really came to appreciate about Star Trek and their level of devotion to continuity, right? Because it's like, obviously, officers, you would gain new skills, you'd get transferred around, you would do all these things in pursuit of a career, right? And to show that so well, I thought was really important to give us kind of expand the world building, right? And to also draw us in, to give us more ways to relate to the shows and to the characters. I mean, we all do the same thing, you know, when seeking, you know, greater fulfillment from our job. Of course, we move to things that we feel like are going to give us that.
Right.
So,
The scene where Picard says bye to him, you know, he comes to meet him in the transporter room and he personally, you know, energizes. That was a great little moment, great little send off, you know, The Next Generation, you know, sending off and bringing in Deep Space Nine as the successor to the show. Good stuff.
So let's see here. We've got a few moments, so let's try to begin our wind down, I guess is the best way to think about it. What were final takeaways? However many you have. I was going to say a couple of, but if you only have one, then so be it.
Oh, man, I don't know if there's anything else at the moment to... there's one other thing. I'm curious to see how this religion that's on... what's the planet we're on?
Bajor,
how that goes. Because as a Christian myself, you know, the Star Trek has, especially from what I've seen already, Deep Space... The Next Generation, doesn't have the highest opinion of religious observance and... You know, that they're now going in that direction. You know, I'm assuming this is going to take much more, front and center. We have an actual religious group on the planet that will be part of the storyline. So it was interesting for me to see, you know, the idea that these orbs are the prophets, and yet when they meet these prophets, these orbs, they didn't intentionally send anyone to these people. So the religion that they've created is, on some level, false, because they've been having to figure out for themselves what's going on. So part of me hopes that they aren't too cruel to... I mean...
So saying the religion is false, I'm going to say that's a bit of a stretch, in my opinion. I think that they... Not to get, you know, jump too deep, but I think they do a very good job of representing... The intrinsic importance of the prophets to the entire formation of the Bajoran people.
Gotcha.
And why it's very appropriate that they consider them gods. And yes, I think they also do a great job of taking that standpoint of, hey, just because you don't believe this doesn't make it any less true to the countless number of people who do believe it. Right. I think they do a good job of presenting that.
Okay.
And I feel like that's one of the things we can definitely learn from this show. But I'm not going to go too deep, because I think that those will be some great conversations when we get there, too. Because there are several episodes feature heavily on the prophets and Bajor and people being like, oh, they're not really gods. They're this. You know, we'll get there. But overall, I think they do a very good job of representing that.
Cool. Okay. We'll be curious to see what happens next.
Okay. Anything that you didn't like in the episode? Like, just when you saw it, just you're like, I don't know. You know, like something that just kind of stuck out to you as not okay.
I don't think there's anything that's standing out to me in the moment. I do, again, think this episode was an improvement on the Next Generation's first episode, as I've said before, basically. So I think in general, I think it's there was nothing that stood out as something I disliked. So, I mean, at the moment, I would say no. Yeah. So far, okay. So good. Yeah.
All right. So, so we're going to go ahead and start our wrap up here. Going to end it with just remembering that we are going to be continuing to include historical context with this show. We did talk very briefly about the fact that we were seeing the end of the Cold War, the rise of multiculturalism. We were also seeing the mass mobilization of like capital markets and neoliberalism at the time too. This is something that we kind of see highlighted in Quark a little bit, which we'll get into more as the show develops, because obviously that becomes a bit more of a thing as the show goes on. So yeah, there are a lot of different things that were significant to the 90s that will play out throughout the run of this show. So I can't wait to get into those with people, and I hope everybody stays tuned for those as well. And speaking of staying tuned, please remember that you can follow us along on our Twitter page, which is called The Fire Caves. If you just do a search on Twitter at The Fire Caves, it pops up. We are also going to be on Spotify. That should be up, I think, the week after this episode drops. So by the time it's on Spotify, you'll actually be able to go back and listen to episode 0 and episode 1 all on the same day. So you get a lot of us all at once if you wait, if you're patient. And as I said before, if you ever have any questions, comments, anything that you've noticed about Deep Space Nine, especially as it relates in a historical context, and you want to make sure it's mentioned on an episode, please feel free to send that to us. Again, we have Facebook, we have Twitter, we have all the things, all the social medias. Just search for The Fire Caves, a Star Trek Deep Space Nine podcast, and I guarantee you will find us, okay? And again, remember, please keep your statements politically correct, polite, so forth. Anything that's intensely derogatory or whatever will not be reviewed. All right, so David, do you have anything final you want to add before we end this broadcast?
I'll see you next week.
All right, guys, so I'm Perry.
I'm David.
Joined with David, and we will be back next week to talk about episode 2 and the further character developments that we see in Star Trek Deep Space Nine. Take care, guys.
Bye.
This show is brought to you by Holosuite Media. Computer, list other available Holosuite Media programs.
Loading Holosuite Preview Program 4, Blast Shield, a Star Trek Lower Decks podcast.
I think we all thought Ransom was going to go into that fight scene, thinking that it was game over before it even started and he was going to lose. But I think the moment he rips his uniform off, which is hard anyway to rip a shirt, but to rip an actual like jacket like that, pretty impressive. And then he had like about, I don't know, I think it's like 62 abs. He just looked ripped, and then he was just like, you know, a little bit of this,
yeah,
a little bit of that.
I was just going to say, it was the way that he also narrated it. It was just perfect. It was great.
Ransom definitely went to the school of Kirk Fu. Ransom Fu, maybe we should be calling it.
Loading Holosuite Preview Program 4, Random Trek Review, a Star Trek Review podcast.
Yeah, the one you mentioned with Dr. Crusher is hilarious because it gets down to her and Captain Picard. And so it's like they have this giant galaxy-class ship and there's just the two of them and he acts like it's a normal thing. And it's just absolutely ridiculous, right? Two people on that giant starship.
And there's even the point where she says, computer, how many personnel would it take to run this ship? And they're like, 832 or something. And Picard's like, oh, yeah, that is kind of weird, I guess. I thought we were just doing it, the two of us, you know? Like, that was pretty funny.
Computer, deactivate Holosuite.